امریکا لە واشنگتن سلاوی ئاسۆ جەبار دەرهێنەری بەرنامەکانی ئەمڕۆتان لێ بێت.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Diane Roberts. U.S. President Joe Biden took executive action Friday to protect abortion access. This comes after the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, the constitutional right to have an abortion. In remarks Friday, the president said the nation must decide between the mainstream and the extreme.
This is a choice. This is a moment. The moment. The moment to restore the rights that have been taken away from us. And the moment to protect our nation from the extremist agenda that is antithetical to everything we believe as American.
British Conservative Rishi Sunak Friday declared his candidacy to become the party's next leader. The former finance minister's resignation from Prime Minister Boris Johnson's cabinet helped spark an exodus of other ministers. Services are scheduled today to remember three of the seven people killed when a gunman opened fire on a 4th of July parade in the U.S. state of Illinois. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
Thursday, it was a vigil.
When we need the names of the 10 people killed in Buffalo, the 19 kids and two teachers killed in Uvalde.
Congressman Brad Schneider, a Democrat who represents Highland Park, linked the July 4th parade shooting to recent massacres in New York and Texas.
We're reading the names of people murdered with weapons of war.
That sound courtesy WLS. Today, services are scheduled for two beloved grandfathers and a former synagogue preschool teacher, 63-year-old Jacqueline Sundheim, 88-year-old Stephen Strauss, and 78-year-old Nicholas Toledo Zaragoza. Services for 69-year-old Eduardo Uvaldo are scheduled for Saturday. I'm Ben Thomas.
This is VOA News. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's White House counsel appeared before the Special Congressional Committee investigating the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. Attorney Pat Cipollone has been behind closed doors in response to a subpoena. The House Select Committee says they will hold two more hearings next week. A nation is still grappling with the violent death of their one-time leader. Former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has died after being assassinated during a campaign speech Friday. Authorities say he was shot in the chest just minutes after he started his speech in western Japan. He was airlifted to a local hospital. The emergency department chief said no bullets were found in Abe's body when he was operated on. He added Abe suffered major damage to his heart, along with two neck wounds that damaged an artery. The 67-year-old was pronounced dead at the hospital. The suspected killer admitted targeting Abe and said he held a grudge against an organization he believed the politician was connected to, police said Friday. He's been identified as a 41-year-old resident of Nara and a former member of Japan's self-defense forces. Japan's current Prime Minister Fumio Kishida describes the assassination of his predecessor as an unforgivable act, AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Kishida tells the media, in the midst of an election, which is the root of democracy, this dastardly event took place. I would like to use the harshest words to condemn this unforgivable act. Kishida adds, Abe had the responsibility as a prime minister for 8 years and 8 months, a record in Japanese politics. Meanwhile, President Joe Biden says he is stunned, outraged, and deeply saddened by the news that my friend Abe Shinzo was shot and killed while out campaigning. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The United Nations Security Council held a minute of silence Friday for assassinated former Prime Minister Abe and Angolan ex-president José Eduardo dos Santos, who died in Spain Friday. Diplomats stood in silence to pay their respects to the two politicians at the UN headquarters in New York before debating a resolution on cross-border aid to Syria. Russia warned Lithuania and the European Union Friday that it could adopt harsh measures against them if the transit of some goods to and from the Russian exclave of Kaliningrad did not resume. A spokesperson of the Russian Foreign Ministry said in a statement, quote, the issue has taken too long to resolve. And recapping our top story, U.S. President Joe Biden took executive action Friday to protect abortion access. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga, and here is what is coming up.
I am very optimistic that a new leader will emerge next year, and that will change the tide of insecurity we're having now.
That was João Santa Rita with VOA's Portuguese service speaking about the death of former Angolan president José Eduardo dos Santos today. And all this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. José Eduardo dos Santos, who ruled Angola for nearly four decades, died today in Barcelona following a prolonged illness. His successor, Angolan President João Lourenço, announced the 79-year-old dos Santos' death. He described dos Santos as a statesman of great historical stature who led the country through very difficult times. Dos Santos stepped down in 2017 after ruling Angola for 38 years. His critics say that time was marked by the plunder of the nation's oil wealth and the enrichment of his family and allies. Despite accusations of corruption and nepotism, many Angolans credit dos Santos with bringing stability to the country. President Lourenço declared 5 days of national mourning in Angola beginning tomorrow. For more on dos Santos' life and legacy, I spoke earlier with my colleague João Santaria from VOA's Portuguese service.
Addressing Parliament Thursday, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed condemned two recent massacres targeting members of the Amhara ethnic group as inhumane acts of violence carried out by evil forces. The most recent massacre took place on Monday in the West Welega zone of Ethiopia's Oromia region, resulting in an unknown number of deaths. Those killings followed a separate incident last month in which armed men killed 338 Amhara villagers, according to official government figures. Ethiopia's government blames the Oromo Liberation Army, or OLA, for the killings. The insurgent group claims to be fighting for greater autonomy for the Oromo people, Ethiopia's largest ethnic group, but it has been accused of a spate of bloody human rights abuses. Speaking to lawmakers on Thursday, Abiy pledged to eliminate the OLA. He also made a rare admission of losses on the government side, saying that police officers and soldiers have been dying on a daily basis battling the insurgent group. He added that warrida, or district officials, have also been assassinated. Hear his words spoken by an interpreter from Ethiopia's state broadcaster.
In Welega, hundreds of reports have been given to you. Hundreds of warrida leaders have been killed. It's not as easy as speaking in this forum. People dying in discharge of their duties.
Abiy's address came a day after Ethiopia's parliament held a moment of silence for the victims of the massacres and set up a committee to investigate. Phone service to the area is down, making it difficult to verify the number of people killed in Monday's violence, which has fueled rising discontent among ethnic Amhara. Fred Harter for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Well, that was a story on Ethiopian rights body urging government to protect human rights, filed from Addis Ababa. Now, we go back to our main story I mentioned about the death of dos Santos. And here I was talking with my colleague moments ago about his life and legacy. João, can you tell us what you know about President dos Santos' illness and death?
Well, we know very little about his illness. As your colleague said, it's been a prolonged illness. He went to Barcelona, to live in Barcelona, to get treatment. He came back to Angola in the beginning of the year. He stayed a few months and he went back to Barcelona, obviously very ill. He had lost a tremendous amount of weight. The immediate death, cause of death, was a cardiac respiratory failure. We have heard that he was on a wheelchair on top of the stairs in the house where he was, and that he fell down the stairs. And that's what caused the accident that caused his immediate death. But we don't know for sure.
I see. Can you talk about his origins in Angola and how he rose to power?
Yeah. Eduardo Santos joined the MPLA, Liberation Movement, when he was very young. 1961. He then, this was at the beginning of the liberation war against the Portuguese. He went then to the former Soviet Union where he got an engineer degree. He came back to stay with the MPLA in Congo-Brazzaville. He represented the MPLA in several African countries. Then at the time of independence, just before actually, 1974, he was appointed for the first time to the Central Committee. He was elected president when the first president, Agostinho Neto, died all of a sudden in 1979. I must say that his election was a surprise. Because he wasn't a prominent member, but I think it was a case of balance, of choosing a common candidate, let's say. So he came to power 79. On his side of... So that's how he came to power as a long-term member of the MPLA.
I see. Let's talk about his legacy in Angola. He led the country, as our listeners may know, for nearly 40 years. How do Angolans view him?
Well, there's two sides to President Dos Santos. He was very important in negotiating actually two peace agreements with UNITA, one in 1992 that failed and the country went back to war, another in 2002. He also negotiated the end of the Cuban presence. Cuba had about 30,000 soldiers in Angola, and the withdrawal of South Africa from parts of Angola and Namibia, which led to Namibia's independence. So he brought a kind of stability to the country in that aspect. On the other hand, his government, you know, the MPLA was a Marxist-Leninist movement. And so with the collapse of the Soviet Union, it had to do a transition to, let's say, a capitalist movement. And the way he did this was through a patronage system, by giving jobs to the entourage and to his family. Mm-hmm. And so there was a tremendous amount of corruption. You know, his daughter, Isabel dos Santos, is the richest woman in Africa. And so I think that's the biggest, let's say, shade over his presidency is the enormous corruption and the stealing of thousands of millions of dollars that just disappeared.
I see. Well, thanks very much, Joao. That was Joao, my colleague. Ghana's health authorities say they have, for the first time, confirmed two fatal cases of the Marburg virus, a relative of the Ebola virus. Kent Mensah reports from Accra, Ghana.
In a statement on Thursday, the Ghana Health Service said the two cases of Marburg virus disease, MVD, were detected in the Ashanti region, about 250 kilometers from the capital, Accra. Blood samples were sent to the Noguchi Memorial Institute for Medical Research, the statement said, adding preliminary results suggest the infection is due to the Marburg disease. Applying standard procedure, the samples have been sent to the Institut Pasteur in Senegal, the World Health Organization, WHO, Collaborating Center for Confirmation, the statement added. The two patients from the southern Ashanti region, both deceased and unrelated, show symptoms that included diarrhea, fever, nausea, and vomiting, the WHO said on its website. So far, 34 persons have since been quarantined and are being monitored for coming in contact with the two infected persons. The health directorate in the region, according to the statement, is currently conducting further investigation on the cases and contacts. It will be the second time Marburg is being detected in West Africa, if Ghana's case is confirmed by the WHO. Guinea confirmed a single case in September 2021. Marburg virus is transmitted by infected persons or animals from direct contact with body fluids, blood, and other discharges from the affected person or animal. The incubation period for the disease is 2 to 21 days. The WHO said Marburg is a disease with a case fatality rate of up to 88%. Prospective patients may suffer from fever, bloody diarrhea, bleeding from gums, bleeding of the skin, bleeding of the eyes, and bloody urine. Kent Mensah for VOA News, Accra, Ghana.
Ethiopia's Human Rights Commission has released a first-of-its-kind report detailing grave violations targeting civilians, including killings and torture by both militias and federal forces. Guillermo Dawit reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Ethiopia's Human Rights Commission has released a first-of-its-kind report detailing grave violations targeting civilians, including killings and torture by both militias and the federal forces. The Ethiopian Human Rights Commission has published a detailed report on human rights violations over the past year, a According to the findings, the country has suffered its worst record of rights violations as conflicts result in a surge of civilian killings. The report documents violations in almost all parts of Ethiopia, from conflict in the north to fighting in Oromia and ethnically motivated killings in southern Gambela, among other regions. According to the report, 740 civilians have been killed, including women, children and elderly, due to the war with Tigray that has advanced into Amhara and Afar regions. The Oromo Liberation Army, an entity that Ethiopian Parliament calls Shane and has labeled a terrorist organization, has also been implicated in civilian killings in the Amhara, Oromia, Gambela and Benishangul regions. The report also notes an alleged massacre in western Oromia last June. In Gambela and Benishangul, other groups have carried out ethnically targeted killings during the past year, while in the south, several people have died due to unrest. The report also blamed government forces for violations targeting civilians, including killings, torture and jailing of over 50 media personnel. The Rights Commission called on the conflicting parties in northern Ethiopia to solve differences and bring individuals implicated in rights violations to justice. It has also called on federal and regional authorities to release all detainees in police custody without due process. Gelmo Dawit for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Leaders of the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda, meeting in Angola this week, agreed to ease tensions and normalize diplomatic relations. The DRC has accused Rwanda of supporting resurgent M23 rebels, who in June seized a border town from the military. Rights groups and analysts have welcomed the move by the two leaders, but say lasting peace means addressing root causes of militias in the DRC. Victoria Munga reports from VOA's Africa News Center in Nairobi, Kenya.
Twizere Bastiste is a livestock farmer in the eastern DRC. He says he fled his village last week to a camp at Ruchuru in North Kivu province after M23 rebels attacked while his animals were grazing. Two of his brothers were killed. He says, my livestock was stolen. My house was demolished. This war should stop so that we can go back to our homes. People are suffering in the camps. We would like to go back home. At least 1.9 million civilians have been displaced in North Kivu this year, according to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. Dozens have been killed since the M23 rebel group resurfaced after a fragile, nearly decade-long ceasefire. They began a major offensive in Congo's eastern borderlands in March. The reemergence of M23 is stirring a political rivalry between Congo and Rwanda. Kinshasa accuses Kigali of supporting M23 to destabilize the country, an allegation Rwanda denies. Officials from the two countries agreed Wednesday to de-escalate tensions from the rebel insurgency, but barely a day later, on Thursday, fresh clashes broke out between the military and the M23 rebels. Right groups say peace cannot be achieved unless both sides address root causes of the conflict, such as lack of accountability for atrocities. Jean Mobert is the Amnesty International researcher on Congo.
Justice is not on the agenda, and unfortunately, as long as those who have been involved in serious crimes in the DRC for the last decades feel like they can continue to kill, to rape, to loot without consequences, this is just going to last.
Masharia Munene, an analyst on international relations in Kenya, told VOA that despite the efforts to achieve peace in eastern Congo, mistrust between leaders of the DRC and its eastern neighbors, Rwanda and Uganda, is a major obstacle.
So first of all, is reduce the suspicion among the key leaders in order to be able to agree on how to deal with M23. Because as long as they are quarreling and disagreeing, the likelihood of having a common approach is very difficult and very hard.
The M23 militia are currently pursuing their biggest offensive in several years. Congo has accepted a proposal for an East African regional force to be deployed to the volatile provinces of Ituri, North Kivu and South Kivu on condition that Rwanda does not take part. Victoria Amunga, VOA Africa News Center, Nairobi, Kenya.
Burkina Faso leader Paul-Henri Damiba's planned reconciliation summit of former presidents got off to a rocky start today. Reuters reported that two of the five former presidents invited by Namibia, Isaac Zida and Michel Kafando, declined to attend. Meanwhile, dozens of protesters were holding a sit-in outside the house of former leader Roch Kabore, the president who was overthrown by Damiba's junta in January. Former President Blaise Compaoré, who was ousted in an uprising in 2014 after 20 years in power, returned yesterday from exile in Ivory Coast to take part in the summit. But many Burkinabes have blasted Compaoré's return as a free man after he was sentenced in absentia early this year to life in prison for complicity in the 1987 murder of his predecessor Thomas Sankara during the coup that brought him to power. The summit was meant to project political unity in the face of spiraling violence by Islamist militants. Sudan's military has been involved in politics for decades, but the main civilian bloc, the Forces for Freedom and Change, rejected a proposal by coup leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan to make way for civilian rule. They argued the political crisis will end with the coup leaders resigning and the forces of the revolution forming a civil government. Joseph Sigo, Director of Research at African Center for Strategic Studies, discussed with VOA's senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi whether there are prospects of excluding the military from Sudan's political scene.
I think so. While that is the model that the military knows and what it wants to retain, the military has done an abysmal job in managing the economy and leading the government. It is why Sudan faces the huge economic hole that it's in and is facing the crisis that it's undergoing right now. The military has also just lost a lot of trust with the popular support among civilians, and therefore it is very difficult to envision how the military could sustain a role politically and get the buy-in that's needed to help stabilize the country. There's also just a practical consideration of, you know, why should the military be in government? Military governments around the world and in Africa have had a terrible track record for governing. And, you know, there's no empirical reason, there's no functional reason why the military should remain in government in Sudan. It's clearly just an interest on the part of the military to maintain their own privileges.
The coup not only worsened a political crisis in Sudan, but has pushed Sudan deeper into a dire economic slump. International actors have been pushing for civilian and military leaders to negotiate a return to the democratic transition. How could the international actors help achieve such a goal?
I think the most important thing that the international actors can do is send a clear signal to the military that only when a genuine civilian government is in place will the international community re-engage with Sudan. To the extent the military believes that they can manipulate an arrangement where there is a technocratic government that's controlled by the military while the military retains the ultimate authority, to the extent they believe that will suffice and that will satisfy demands from international actors, then that's what they're going to try and pursue. So I think it's important that international actors clearly indicate that there needs to be a genuine, popularly supported civilians are in control of the government before they engage, and then that the international community can work with the civilian leadership to undo the major economic challenges that Sudan faces. Sudan has over 350% inflation, even before the recent spikes in prices we've seen globally following the Russian invasion in Ukraine. Sudan has had a contracting economy for years, and so it's been difficult for ordinary citizens to access basic goods. Sudan has a ballooning debt approaching, you know, $1.2 trillion. Again, all of this is because of gross economic mismanagement and largesse on the part of the military government. And so international actors need to just reaffirm that it's only when civilians are in place that there will be the assurances that the civilian government will maintain financial transparency, uphold the rule of law, respect contracts that will then enable a renewal of debt relief development assistance, and private sector investments.
That was Joseph Sigo, Director of Research at African Center for Strategic Studies, who's discussing with VOA's senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shanawi. You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us at voaafrica.com.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. Next up, a look at how the U.S. Justice and State Departments team up to involve more women in counterterrorism efforts around the world. We talk with Laurie Freeman from State and Heather Roche from Justice to learn the benefits of gender diversity in operational effectiveness and the overall fight against terrorism in Africa, Asia, or the Middle East. The vital role of women in counterterrorism this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says the caretaker government he now leads will continue with policies he had set earlier, including the controversial plan to deport some asylum seekers to Rwanda. Johnson resigned yesterday as head of Britain's Conservative Party after dozens of his government appointees resigned. He will remain in office until the party elects a new leader. Milton Alimadi is the publisher and owner of the Black Star News in New York. I reached him there and began by asking him how the changes in the British government could affect Africa.
Well, I don't see it as significantly different in terms of shifting British policy toward Africa over any other period. In fact, I think there was a belief that he might be a little more less supportive because, as you recall, he eliminated the Office of Development. So in terms of his seeing Africa as a priority, I'm not sure that he was any better for the continent. In fact, it seems to me that the British, the United States, they always have more conversations about Africa in terms of challenging what China is doing in Africa instead of having their own independent policy that assesses what Africa needs and how to mutually build a relationship. So that's what I would say.
How will this change in Britain affect Africa, in your opinion?
Well, actually, I hope somebody with a better vision and understanding would come forward as the next prime minister, because as you know, Africa's needs right now, given the pandemic, given the economic disruption of the last 2-3 years, Africa needs a couple of things. Africa needs, first of all, total debt relief. And nobody's taking that conversation seriously. Given the diminishing of economic activity over the last 2-3 years, there's no way that the continent can recover while paying a substantial amount, up to 60% in some cases, of their exchange earnings just to service the debt alone. So that's number one. That's what Africa needs. And in the meantime, in addition to total debt cancellation, Africa needs vaccine equity. The percentage of the population that's been vaccinated is abysmal. And that is a shame to the rest of the world. The countries that are developed that can afford to provide the vaccine, they're literally holding the continent hostage. But without the entire world being vaccinated, there's no way that these developed countries can maintain that level of health at the same time. This is a global disease, a global pandemic, so it has to be confronted in a global manner, not selectively. And to be honest with you, going back to our Prime Minister Boris Johnson, he had some very harsh words to say about Africa in the past. As you may know, he wrote an article years ago saying Africa is a mess, but we can't blame colonialism. And he also wrote something like, the problem is not that we were not in charge, but that we are no longer in charge of Africa. And he called Africa a blot. And he said Africa is not a blot on our conscience. I have to return the favor to him. I don't think he will be missed. I think if Boris Johnson is a blot to Britain, he is not a blot to Africans. And Africans should not miss him. We hope there can be a new prime minister who takes Africa much more seriously than Boris Johnson ever did.
Do you think a change in government there will affect Africa in terms of policy?
I think so. I think it's very hard to me to imagine the problems that the British themselves experience under this prime minister, that they would tolerate a prime minister of the caliber of Boris Johnson.
That was Milton Alimadi. I spoke to him earlier from New York. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington. For all latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.